published, and several works of nonfiction. She has won every award this country can offer its best writers, and she is internationally acclaimed. We connect with her work in various ways. I have most appreciated her analysis of the pioneer mind in a wonderful set of poems published in the Journal of Susanna Moody. But whatever we like or dislike in the work of Margaret Atwood, this work has left its mark on us. She has become part of what this country is in this generation, part of what we are. Somewhere she has said that the perseverance in the art of writing will take you places you never intend to go and show you things you would never otherwise have seen. Her work has done that to us all. And eventually, most of us have recognized that what we would not otherwise have seen quite so clearly has been ourselves in our setting. That, I think, is all I can say, other than to thank you, Margaret Atwood, for coming to this university to give a Del Grauer Memorial Lecture yesterday and to speak to the Vancouver Institute tonight. Such a trip is arduous for you, but appreciated, as you can see, by a great many here. We have all met you before in your writing. We esteem you. We welcome you. Margaret Atwood, Blood and Thunder.
My first question is always, though, is the mic going to be short enough? And it's almost short enough. Can it come a bit this way? No.
We can use this one.
Okay, we'll try that one. All right. How's that? How about using both at once? Is that even better? I just got these. As you know, one of a writer's stock in trades is suspense, and tonight's lecture will be filled with it, at least from my point of view. For instance, will I be able to get through this speech without falling over? The potential reason is not a problem with strong drink. Even in this age of equal rights, it is not yet either chic or endearing for a female writer to topple headfirst into the soup or off the podium, though it may arouse fellow feeling or maternal solicitude in the audience if other kinds do so, but a problem of another kind. It's been a while since I've lived in Vancouver over the winter, and I've forgotten a few things. Because of this, I neglected to bring my hip waders and took a brisk but long walk through the university endowment lands during the flood on Thursday, wearing a pair of rubber shoes belonging to someone else. These produced a pair of big, beautiful, supernatural British Columbia blisters. And my feet are killing me. My speech on Friday had some claims to objectivity, but this one is entirely personal. Invite a writer to speak, and you get a writer speaking 9 times out of 10, and this is one of the 9. You may have figured out that this preamble is a bit of an apologia, because I feel somewhat intimidated by the other speakers in this series. Why? Because I'm not an expert on anything, and this is the age of experts. I feel I've got in under slightly false pretenses, not exactly a wolf among the sheep, more like a yarn spinner among the dentists. P- Possibly I should have emulated William Golding, the only other one of us without a professorial or doctorish prefix, and called this lecture Thoughts. But even that might have been too pretentious for what you're about to hear, which is the gurgling of a writer's mind when it is not being used for writing. This will be a rambling and disconnected speech, partly because I'm a rambling and disconnected person. Well, you know about the artistic temperament, shouts of Eureka coming from the bathtub when you should just be having a bath and so on, and partly because I'm still doing time on the Cross Canada Kill an Author Tour, which is our society's main way of punishing people for having the presumption to write novels. Anyone who does this tour comes out the other end feeling like a cross between scrambled eggs and a used car salesman, and that's how I feel this evening. If anyone had told me 30 years ago that I'd end up as a sort of part-time cultural Fuller Brush person, I'd have been more than perplexed. The book, by the way, is The Handmaid's Tale, a mere 22.95. Price of a good steak dinner with coffee, wine, and tip, and you should not get it out of the library, but on the contrary, should rush off to purchase one forthwith. Many pressing questions which deeply concern you personally are addressed with nail-gnawing particularity in this valuable book. Well worth the price, as it will help you lose weight through anxiety and can be recycled as a Christmas gift if you have taken care not to smear the pages with nicotine or chocolate or any vestiges of the other secret vices in which you can hardly help but indulging in order to ease the pressures attendant upon surviving daily life here and now in beautiful supernatural British Columbia. Especially if you happen to be an academic. But enough of that for now. You probably wonder what the rather ominous title of this so-called lecture, Blood and Thunder, may portend. By this time, so do I. As you may not know, lectures like this are arranged far in advance of the event, and this one has been in the works for at least 5 years. You may credit the perseverance of Bill Nemitz for finally getting me here. When we finally agreed last winter that my body and my soul could both be brought together in the same space tonight, the organizers of the series quite naturally pressed me for some sort of a title, and I just as naturally provided them with one. I did not know at the time that I would have my novel finished and published by the due date of the lecture. I thought I might still be writing it, or that it would have become a wad of scrap papers suitable only for keeping beside the telephone for writing phone numbers on the backs. So I gave a title which would have been suitable for one of my pet projects, one that I thought I might be industriously working away on by now. Blood and Thunder is an old phrase which refers to a certain kind of narrative poetry composed with public recitation in mind, and in fact often performed in public, popular in the latter half of the 19th century and the first 25 years or so of the 20th. There are strange things done neath the midnight sun by the men who moil for gold, and a bunch of the boys were hooping it up in the Malamute Saloon, are the opening lines of a couple of still well-known favorites, but there's more, lots more, once famous, now alas, obscure. The Wreck of the Julie Plant by W.H. Drummond, for instance, and a number of hair raisers and tear jerkers by Pauline Johnson, whom we knew at school only through the rather vapid poem, The Song My Paddle Sings, but who turns out to have been a lot racier than I, at any rate, ever thought. These poems were meant to hold audiences, and I expect they did, since their subject matter is rarely less than sensational. Murders, fights, stabbings, rape, betrayed love, revenge, various natural calamities such as shipwrecks, drownings, burnings, and squashings, crushings to death in log jams, leaps from precipices, and freezings to death. This was before television. And the National Enquirer. So the natural human appetite for such material had to be satisfied by poets. Why did I want to talk about this tradition? Because I found it to be A, interesting, and B, neglected. This last a good Canadian reason for resurrecting almost anything. What would I have said about it? Ah, many things. I might have gone into the institution of the school recital, once widespread, during which children got up and rendered, with dramatic gestures and appropriate vocal pitch, various heart-rending examples of this genre, which they may have memorized or not, as the case may be. I might have made reference to Anne of Green Gables. Anne, as you'll recall, was a champion reciter, and even quoted Mark Twain's satire upon this species, The Ballad of Stephen Dowling Bots, which ends, "His young life did this cruel world flee by falling down a well." I might have fished out a certain 19th century how-to book in my possession, which gives instructions for how to recite movingly, complete with illustrations. I might have illustrated dejection, hope, and the like. Our ancestors were, I think, considerably more theatrical than we've been led to believe. I might have talked about the influence of this tradition on earlier lyric Canadian poetry and tied it in with, for instance, the narrative form as practiced today, or modern voice poets such as Bill Bissett and B.P. Nichol. I might have done many of these things. Why didn't I? Well, in a nutshell, I didn't get around to it. For one thing, I started spending 24 hours a day, more or less, on the aforementioned unforgettable novel, a must for every serious student, not only of literature, but of life. In other words, I entered that state of spaced-out hyperdrive, which every novelist prays for, in which the pages flow out of the typewriter, or in my case, out from under the Pentel ultrafine pen, and the mail piles up unread, and you become very easy, although somewhat puzzling to live with, because you don't, in fact, actually hear anything at all that is said to you, at least not the first time. But more of that a bit later. The other things that happened were, I finished the book. I came back from Alabama, where I'd been finishing it. I did the editing. I went to Alaska. I came back. It was summer vacation. I read The Galleys. I bought a different house and moved into it, thus discovering many little heaps of neglected junk I had forgotten about. I read the page proofs. I went to northern Quebec. I dealt with the school wardrobe problem for my daughter, purchasing several useful but attractive outfits which she has not yet worn, as she is now into pants and my oversized sweaters. I dealt with the blocked sink problem, the eaves trough problem. Eaves troughs that have not been cleaned out for 10 years yield wonderful potting soil. The removal of the bathroom that had been built into the front hall back in the 50s when the erstwhile spacious family home had been turned into a rooming house problem. You see how it goes. Writers are real people too, some of the time. Meanwhile, the deadline for this lecture was looming closer and closer. There was that title staring me in the face. Maybe I thought I might fake it. As the mode solidified from the conditional subjunctive to the indicative, no more maybes, no more mights, the question became one of method, not whether to fake it, but how. Perhaps, I thought, I could pretend the organizers of the series had misheard me over the phone, like the Quebec promoters of my novel, Bodily Harm, who thought the title was Bodily Arm. And that it was therefore an exercise in surrealism. Maybe I could pretend I'd really said, not blood and thunder, but spud and blender. In that case, I could talk about one of my other pet projects, one that did not get shoved aside by real life the way the actual blood and thunder had, one that I was in fact currently working on. This project is for a worthy cause, which I'll make the plug for in a minute, and is in fact a cookbook. It will be called The Can-Lit Cookbook. I have so far resisted the temptation to call it The Can-Lick Cookbook, and it will not consist of authors' favorite recipes. Why not? Because for one thing, you can never get authors to send any in. I'm not sure why this is. It could be that they don't eat, but I can hardly believe this, or that they send out for pizza. Whatever the reason, they take care to supply the characters in their books with many and varied edibles. The idea is to collect as many scenes as possible from Canadian novels, and yes, Canadian poems and even certain kinds of Canadian nonfiction, items, that is, in which food of any sort is prepared or consumed. We already have a number, Michael Ondaatje's poem, Rat Jelly, for instance, Dennis Lee's Alligator Pie, the scene in Never Cry Wolf in which Farley Mowat eats lemmings to see if they're nutritious, the scene from Anne of Green Gables, again, where Anne gets Diana drunk on Marilla's raspberry cordial, the scene in which Japheth gets marinated and turns blue in Timothy Findlay's Not Wanted on the Voyage, and even some straighter scenes like the Christmas feast in Robertson Davies' Rebel Angels, and some good Back to the Land apple pie and red zinger tea from Audrey Thomas's intertidal life. Should anything spring to your mind, do not hesitate to send it in. The worthy cause is PEN International, Canadian Center, PEN standing for Poets and Playwrights, Editors and Essayists and Novelists, and being an international writers' organization committed to getting writers in other countries out of prison. Collins will publish it. We've already auctioned it off for a whopping but gratifying sum, so you see it's one project of mine that actually will get finished. Well, Spud and Blender was a good idea, but I didn't think I could spin it out for more than about 5 minutes. Hey, I said to myself, what about Cud and Binder? That could be about yet another of my favorite projects, this time a foray into Canadian regionalism. It has struck me in recent years that much has been done on regionalism as it exists in provinces other than Ontario. The usual ploy in such approaches is to view Ontario as some kind of center, but not many have noticed that Ontario is itself a region. With this in mind, I recently devised and even taught a university course for one of those guest spots in the States where they give you a wad of money and a dwelling and let you rave on, called Southern Ontario Gothic. This course claimed to examine, more or less, the intersection of a geographical and cultural region and a literary tradition, and was a smash hit, or at least intelligible, in Alabama, where they also have crumbling family mansions, ghosts, spectacular deaths, and strange doings out behind the hayrick. For as you can tell by the title, Cud and Binder, works in the Southern Ontario Gothic tradition tend to be set in rural, or at least small town Ontario. My course began with Robertson Davies' Fifth Business and World of Wonders, and worked its way along through, among others, Timothy Findlay's Last of the Crazy People and the Wars, Marion Engel's Bear, Matt Cohen's Flowers of Darkness, Alice Munro's Lives of Girls and Women, Graham Gibson's Five Legs, Helen Weinzweig's Basic Black with Pearls, one of the few true urban examples, and ended in a blaze of mayhem with James Rainey's trilogy, The Donnellys, touching along the way upon hauntings, doppelgangers, apparitions, magic, animal transformations, stopped time, suicides, multiple murders, premonitory visions, secret identities, doom and gloom, seductions in the midst of thunderstorms, and eyeballs stuck to the bathroom wall. That's in the Cohen book. And certainly presented a snappier version of life in Ontario than you're likely to hear on the weather report or see in the tourist brochures. I had fun talking about it, and I'll do it again in New York in 1986, and I thought it might make good material for a quick recycling, but I changed my mind about that too. I'm sure you'll agree that Cut and Binder, as a pigeonhole, contains much more material than can easily be chewed up and digested in a mere 45-minute verbal 100-yard dash. I could have taken a less literary and more global approach and split the title into two different parts, Blood on the one hand and Thunder on the other, in which case this would have been about two other concerns of mine, blood for the work of Amnesty International and its worldwide anti-torture campaign, and thunder for nuclear war. These are not cheerful subjects, although they are pressing ones, but each deserves more time and research than I was able to give them at the present time. By this time, you'll probably have concluded that I should have scrapped the attempt to produce some plausible variation of my original title and just called the thing One Author in Search of a Subject with Unclear and Not Very Successful Results, otherwise known as Thud and Blunder. I could have favored you with my thoughts on recent politics, local and national, grab and plunder. Or on my observations on the attempt to solve the problem of street prostitution, bawd and pander. But the truth is that at the moment I'm pretty well drained of thoughts and observations, and I don't even have an interesting specialty to fall back on, say runic inscriptions north of Lake Superior, a subject in which I take an interest, but on which I'm hardly qualified to speak. I've put so much thought and observation into my recent book that the inside of my head resembles an airport. There's a lot of activity, but not really much going on, except the inevitable waiting. Because that's what writers, as writers, not as compilers of cookbooks, teachers of courses, anthologizers of neglected verse, even purchasers of school wardrobes, even members of worthy free speech and civil rights organizations, that's what writers, as writers, really do a great deal of. The rest is citizenship, and you could do it quite well, perhaps better, without being a writer at all. Because if you weren't a writer, you could get right down to it, have a system, be organized, without the unpredictable mental absences that afflict writers. Writers are not really members of a profession, though they often get together and make those kinds of noises, which they have to do for survival, about contracts, grants, publishing conditions, library lending rights, and so on. Dentistry is a profession. You go to school, you study it up, you graduate, and lo, another dentist. You even get a certificate to hang on the wall that says so. But how do you graduate as a writer? You never do. Dentists have to turn out predictably perfect fillings. Writers never get to the point at which they know they can predictably turn out a perfect book or poem or even a good one. Writers aren't specialists. They are probably the last of the generalists. The mind of any writer I've ever known has been a lot like the sock drawer just before you tidy it up. There's a lot more in there than socks, usually, but in no discernible order. Writing is less profession than vocation, which is why the students of creative writing programs often have such a dedicated, hollow-eyed, and sometimes sanctimonious air about them. Perhaps their classes should not be called seminars, but seminaries. Waiting, then, for what? Matthew Arnold phrased it, waiting for the spark from heaven to fall. There can be debate about the nature of this spark and its present location, and about whether it falls down or wells up, but no one who has ever written poetry or fiction would deny the experience of its existence. You wait, then, for something like that, and in the meantime, you kill time, do the dishes, walk the dog. You even try to write, on the theory that piano players need to practice and pumps need priming. Alice Munro once said to me, "I try to write something every day, even when I know it's crap." I myself am the author of countless execrable first drafts and two unfinished novels, which remain unfinished because that thing, the thing that ignites the work, was not there. You can't do anything to call it into being or make it happen, except, I suppose, the equivalent of prayer, incantation, and the practice of ritual, the daily paper offering to the god of the typewriter. This is the pretentious, embarrassing part of writing, the part that writers don't often talk about in public because it sounds so dough-headed and inflated. They'd rather talk about technique and craft and demonstrable things like that, if technique and craft are demonstrable. I don't blame them, and that's what I talk about most of the time myself when I'm called upon to talk about writing, and I'm not practicing other evasive tactics. But what I've said is true nonetheless, and every writer knows it. When you've just finished a book and you think it's a good book, you have two questions. The first one is, how did I do that? Because really, already, you can't quite remember. And the second is, will I ever be able to do that again? Because you don't really know. No one who wants a pension plan, a sure thing, something to show for it, predictably, at the end, should ever become a writer. Because yes, it's hard work, but it's also gambling and moonshine. I don't think I've told you very much, really, this evening, nor have I lived up to my admittedly titillating title. There hasn't been much blood or very much thunder either, but then I've chosen tonight process over product. Blood and thunder is quite obviously a description of a product. It's something the reader might end up with after the writer has written. If it were a description of the process itself, the title would have to be Bleeding and Thundering, and there may be some of both those things when writing is in process. Possibly the real subject of my quasi-lecture has been not what is it like to be a writer, you know, famous and such, but what is writing like? Which leads me to the last inevitable, irresistible, inexcusable title of the evening, for which I cringe and apologize in advance. But you see, the verbal process has its own momentum. The writer becomes subject to the writing, and it writes you, and you are swept along, a mere beetle in the stream. This title is about what writing is like. It is not blood and thunder. Instead, it is plod and wonder. Because what writing is really like is this. You're watching your feet as you walk along a very ordinary sidewalk in your everyday shoes. You put one foot in front of the other and then take the next step and the next, and you go forward and you sense the pull of gravity, and it seems harder than usual, and you feel as if you're walking through mud. Then all of a sudden, there's no sidewalk there at all. Only what? clear air, light, amazement, and you feel you're doing quite easily, but without meaning to, something you shouldn't have been able to do at all. This is now what, the 50-second dash. Lead the way.
The 10-minute dash or so. We'll be back in about that time.
Can they hear what's going
They'll
on?
They'll hear.
Okay.
Yes.
You get the first questions. What? No questions? Well, that's easy. That's one. Yes. My address. Well, let me put it this way. How long did I take to write the speech was the question. I'll answer it elliptically by saying, how long did it take me to write my novel? It took 3 years of thinking about it and 9 months of writing it. And I suppose you could say, how long did it take me to write this speech? Probably about 10 years of thinking about the various things involved in it and 6 hours writing it. Somebody said, when a painter was quoting the price for one of his pictures, they said, well, that's too much. And he said, but you're paying for 40 years of experience. So I think that's about the way it is. It's not the time you put in, it's the other time. I will do all the other things eventually that I that I haven't gone around to yet. But sooner or later I do them. Yes? Yeah, the question is, she saw me in Fredericton in 1974 and it was her impression there were only 12 people there. I don't think so. There's two answers to that. Possibly if I did it in Fredericton this year, there would be the same number of people there. There were in 1974. But it feels exactly the same. I mean, I don't feel any different. Fredericton is Fredericton, but, you know, 12 was not my experience in 1974. I think you'd have to go back to some place like 1961. But even then, I started reading poetry in 1960 in Toronto at the Bohemian Embassy, and it was always full, you know? Not because of me, but because of the thing, the program there. I don't think there's any difference. Fame is in the mind of the beholder, not in the mind of the person who's famous. Sometimes it gets into the mind of the person who's famous, and if so, it's usually destructive. That is, you start thinking you're somebody other than you are, or that you have some kind of supernatural powers that you don't have. And I've seen it do bad things to people, but this is Canada, and I am I am not Elizabeth Taylor, and being famous in Canada is somewhat less traumatic than it can be in other countries, let us say, because Canadians have a feeling. Canadians are somewhat like Australians, who have a saying in Australia: they cut tall poppies here. And Canadians are slightly suspicious about fame, and they take care to sort of shoot at your ankles with their pea shooters from time to time, just to remind you that in fact you've got ankles. And I mean, we do not worship fame the way certain other countries that shall remain nameless do. When I said, why do I want to resurrect this material because it's neglected, that also is a very Canadian thing. Canadians like to even things out. If something gets too neglected, they like to resurrect it and pay attention to it. If it gets too famous, they like to bring it down to size a bit. You know, it's the co-op tradition. So even if I got too bloated, some members of my critical audience would make sure to trim me down a bit. Yes. Okay. Young writers today, what kind, prose or poetry? What advice would I give to young writers today, of writers of prose and poetry? First of all, is it advice you're wanting about how to publish or about writing itself? All right. Try to do it every day, the way Alice Munro said. Now, that's the advice for prose. Fiction. The advice for poetry is different because, in my mind, you can't force poetry. A novel you have to work at, otherwise you'd never get it done. You have to sit down in front of it every day, whether you feel like it or not, and just work at it. You may end up throwing that part out later on, but you have to do it. Poetry, what you have to do instead is create space. That's even more concerned with what I said about waiting. And it's why other people get very irritated with poets a lot of the time, because they look as if they're not doing anything. They look as if they're gazing out the window a lot and wasting time. But in fact, you need that empty space, because if there is no empty space in your life, poetry cannot come into it. Poetry likes emptiness in the poet. The other thing I would recommend for poets is that they read a lot of poetry. It seems to have a generative effect. And apart from that, there are no rules. And even that is not a rule, it's a suggestion. Yes. Having lived outside of Canada, has having lived outside of Canada changed my perception of Canada or of Canadian literature? I first lived outside Canada in 1961-3, when I went away to graduate school. And because I had grown up in the 50s and come through an educational system that had just about nothing about Canada included in it, and because that Canada was not a topic at that time. And because Canadian writers were not at all well known, they weren't public figures, nobody paid much attention to them, and most of them of the generation right before mine had felt they had to leave the country because there wasn't an audience for them, I didn't think about Canada before I left the country. I hardly thought about it at all. But living in Boston and Cambridge, which is in some ways quite similar to Canada, it's not like going to Texas, it made me really think very hard about what it was to be Canadian, because here was this place that seemed in many respects similar, but it was obviously very different. So what were the differences? And that's when I first put a lot of time into thinking about Canada, and so did the other Canadians there. They used to huddle in bars and say things like, their mailboxes are different from ours. our subway is cleaner. Things like that. Yes, it does make you think more about your country to be outside it. And I've now lived in a number of different countries, but nothing was equal to that first 2 years during which I really gnawed my nails over this subject. I then came back to Canada in 1963, and I worked for a market research company. And one of the questions on one of those market researches questionnaires was, do you think there is any difference between Canada and the United States? And most of the people answering said no. And the next question was, do you want to join the United States? And most people answering the question said no. And what that meant to me was that people felt there was a difference, but because it hadn't been articulated for them, they couldn't say yes to the first question because it hadn't been verbalized. But they felt the difference, and therefore they said no to the second question. No, they didn't want to join. So I felt somebody should articulate it, and I set about doing that. Why did I go to Alabama to finish my book? I didn't go to Alabama to finish my book because I didn't know when I accepted the invitation from Alabama that I would be writing a book. You see, that's the way it goes. You can't plan your life ahead of time if you're a writer. It happened to be lucky that I did that. And I always sort of cackle over the Canada Council forums because I write a lot of recommendations for other people. And they expect you to put down what you're going to be doing in the next year. You know, it's always a guesswork and fabrication, but because you don't know. What if it doesn't work? What if you have to throw it out? Anyway, there I was finishing this novel unpredictably. It happened to be a good place for me to do that, but it wasn't planned. It was a good place because the phone never rang. And when it did, it was for my daughter.
I'm sorry, but we really must go on. Too bad.
Yes.
I think I read somewhere that when you were a child, there was a part of your life where you didn't go to
school. Yes.
This is also true of Doris Lessing, who I also greatly admire. And do you think children should go to school?
Oh, the question is that she read somewhere that when I was young, there are parts of my life during which I didn't go to school. And it's also true of Doris Lessing. And do I think children should go to school? It's true that until I was in grade 8, I never spent a full year in school. I would spend the winters in school, and the spring, summers, and falls I would spend in the Quebec North. My mother, having been a school teacher, was able to get that part done very quickly so we could go outside. Do I think children should go to school? Well, this is a very long question. I think children should be educated, but I don't think school is the only place where that happens. And I think school is sometimes used as a kind of babysitting service. You know, rather than... Anyway, we could talk about this for a long time. I can't think in right now of an alternative. Most children used, of course, not to go to school. School was only for the rich and noble. Children were educated at home. But what was turned out by that process was replicas of the parents. And when compulsory education came in, one of the functions that it was thought to serve was to get children out of families where their educational possibilities were very limited, and to give them increased possibilities. And it did accomplish that. So if you're going to say no school, you're going to have to think up something, some other way of doing it that would work. That's my answer. Yes? Okay, is there anything that I could say about how I can tell when one of my poems is finished? When you're very, very lucky with the poem, you can be very close to it the first draft or the second draft. That's infrequent with me, but it does happen. And in those cases, I know that it's finished. And I can't tell you how. On the other hand, there can be poems that you never finish. You get bits and pieces of them, and you work away at them, and it doesn't work. And so you put them in a drawer. And then you might get another piece of that poem, say, 2 or 3 years later. And you might add it on, and you might get a finished poem, or you might not. And that could go on for a long time. And the poems they aren't thrown out. They're just there. They're unfinished poems. There's no way of telling. There's no way that I can tell you how to tell. It's an inner thing. It's the same as, you know, how do you tell a painting is finished? Can't we just add a bit more red? Well, to do that would be to ruin it. You have to feel it. Yes. Would I wish for my daughter to become a writer? I try to keep my mind blank on that subject. And my own mother's attitude was, well, dear, whatever you want to do, as long as it makes you happy. And I think that's how mothers ought to be. You see, I learned that from my mother. I don't think that parents should have a preconceived notion of what their child should or shouldn't be. I think you should wait and let the child decide. So I can't say yes or no.
I'm sorry, we're going to have to move to the next hall.
Good thing it was a short speech. This thing isn't on. Not on. Does that mean the folks in the lobby are out of luck? Okay. Well, I'm glad the mic isn't on. The question was, in case it is somehow mysteriously on, is it now on? Yes. Okay. Could I comment on my movie Surfacing, and would I wish any of my other books to be made into films? Well, I'll dodge the first one by saying the mushrooms were wrong. Wrong mushrooms. And the canoe paddling was not up to scratch. The answer to the second one, you've got two choices when somebody wants to buy the film rights to one of your books. You do not have author control. That is never possible. The only thing you can do is take your name off it. You can usually get some kind of legal provision that allows you to take your name off. Why do you not get author credit? Do. That's just the nature of movies. So then you can decide, am I going to sell the film rights and use the money to write another novel with, or am I going to teach university? You know, those are the kinds of decisions that come your way. So those are your choices. Yes. How do I feel about the Canadian feminist movement, and would I consider myself part of it? The feminist movement is not one thing anymore. So how do I feel about the Canadian feminist movements, I think is probably the question. Would I consider myself part of them? what do we mean? Feminism has become such a widely used term that it's also become very hazy. So then you have to narrow it down and ask the person what they mean by feminist. If we start at rock bottom, do women have souls? You know, for instance, are women human beings? How many think yes? Only one guy put up his hand. Okay, suppose we answer yes to that. If women are human beings, what are the implications of that? You know, how far do we want to take that? Then you can follow it all the way up. And I think I could probably take it about 5 more stages and have everybody in the room agree that they were feminists. Okay? Then you can take it a couple of stages beyond that. Now, when it goes all the way to, do you think men should be eliminated? then that's where I count myself out. if that's what we mean by it, the answer is no. And that's what some people do mean by it, but not very many. So, you decide what you mean by it, then ask me, and I'll tell you. Right. How did I ever get into writing? It's the first step, yeah. Okay, the question is, how did I ever get into writing? The questioner has just recently discovered that he likes it, but is not sure whether he should follow through on it. Well, you heard what I said. If you're after a sure thing, don't, because it isn't a sure thing. If you wish to, if you feel a calling, it's no other way of putting it, if you feel a vocation, then you have to. So ask those two questions. How did I get into it? A big thumb came down from the sky when I was 16 and said, you. I had not been planning to be a writer. I had quite other ideas. But suddenly I was writing, and it was more compelling than anything else I was doing. And at that time in Canada, there was no conceivable way of making a living at it. So I then searched about to find something I could make a living at and still have time left over for writing. I did not make a living at it for 16 years after I began. I had to make my living doing other things. And I was brought up by my parents to believe that you ought to support yourself financially, so I wasn't sucking blood out of anybody else to do that. So those are the things you have to consider. It's not easy, and nothing is guaranteed. Okay? One more. Yes. Yes. Okay, The Handmaid's Tale she found intriguing but also a bit confusing, and she wondered what prompted me to write it. I got the idea of that thing you can't predict or make happen in 1981. And I evaded writing the book for about 3 years because I thought it was too weird and that it would just get me into too much trouble. But it was obvious. I mean, books have a way of insisting that they be written. And I was writing another book, which was quite jolly and upbeat, and it just wasn't working. And this other book, The Handmaid's Tale, kept intruding on the book I was trying to write. It kept getting in there, and it didn't belong there. So I thought, well, the only way I'm going to get rid of this thing is to write the book that insists on intruding. and then it will feel satisfied. It's sort of like feeding ghosts. You know that if you have a ghost in your house, you're supposed to feed it, and then it will be satisfied and go away. Did you know that? So that's what I know from Southern Ontario Gothic. So I think that's what it's like, that if you don't write the things that are compelling, you know, that insist on being written, you will be haunted. Aren't writers superstitious? Yes.
Writers have different work habits. New Zealand's Janet Frame, when she has the spirit, is alleged to just write day and night for a week until it's finished. Kingsley Amis apparently writes 9 to 5 an hour for lunch. When you're being moved by the spirit, how do you work?
Okay, the question is, what are my work habits? And different different writers have different ones. Some people, for instance, Ryder Haggard is alleged to have written She in 6 weeks. And to have had no memory of the process afterwards. I usually start off slow, because starting a book is really, it's either like jumping off a cliff. Well, it's partly like jumping off a cliff, and it's partly like going into very cold water. And I'm one of those people who is easily distracted and will evade the experience of starting a book for quite a long time, because I find it shocking and unpleasant. That is, it's you know you're going to immerse yourself in something that will be very compulsive, and parts of which you won't like. So I do go to movies and things. But so I start slow, and I try to set myself maybe 2 pages a day to begin with, which doesn't sound like much, but when you're starting, it's slow. Then, if the book starts going, I speed up. And towards the end, I will work 10 hours a day without lunch. Or, you know, I might remember to have lunch, but I usually set an alarm clock, and that reminds me that it's time to have lunch, that sort of thing. But that's right at the end. That's maybe in the last 3 weeks or so. Because by that time in a book, you really are breathing and sleeping the book. I anyway have dreams about it, and I wake up in the middle of the night and write phrases down beside the bed, that sort of thing. It's not something that one wishes to go into lightly, which is, I think, why I spend so much time avoiding it to begin with. Yes.
Do you reread your novels?
Do I reread my novels? Well, by the time a novel comes out in print, you've read it many times. First of all, you write it. I write in longhand, and then I type. And I usually write about 20 pages in longhand, and then I start typing at page 1 while I'm writing page 21 in longhand, and that process goes on. I'll spend half the day doing the longhand writing and the other half typing what I wrote a couple of days ago. So you get through to the end, you've read it once. Then you revise it, and that's more reading of it. Then when it's all revised, and that can be up to 6 times, you read the galleys. Then you read the page proofs. And then the book comes out. And by that time, you really don't want to read it anymore for a while. After a couple of years, I'll go back and read it, and I'll think, you know, that's not bad, Canadian thing. Or sometimes I'll think, you know, that's idiotic. But certainly right after you finished a book, you feel like a banana peel, and you just don't really want to read it very much, except that you have to, because you have to go around giving readings from it. But that's not like reading the whole thing. I think that once the book is written, It's the reader who has to read it next. The writer gets to read the next one. Yes, one more. Okay, what implications do I think The Handmaid's Tale has for women's roles in our future society? A couple of answers to that. Handmaid's Tale is speculative fiction, but it's very carefully based on things that are now happening or that have happened in the past or for which we've got the machinery to make them happen. There's nothing that's pure invention. There's nothing that's sort of the outpourings of my demonic imagination. The human race is quite capable of thinking up demonic things all on its own without any help from me. So I just plagiarized history for The Handmaid's Tale. But it does bring together a number of trends that are coming towards us along the railroad track, and one of them is the increasing toxification of the atmosphere, which cannot help but have an effect on birth rate, sterility rate, birth defect rate, and if you think that's not going to affect women, you're wrong. You know, obviously it will affect women. If the birth rate goes down low enough, fertility will become a valuable commodity, and it will be controlled. And there's not a state in existence today of any development that doesn't have some state policy affecting the birth rate. In Romania, as you read at the back of the book, there's a law in force right now which says, because the Romanian birth rate is very low, no birth control of any kind, compulsory pregnancy tests once a month, and wages and promotion pegged to the number of children you have for women. Okay, it's not, you know, I don't make this stuff up. It's happening now. So the implications, well, the implications are in the book. The other thing that's in the book is if a totalitarian form of government were to take place in the United States, would it call itself communism? Not likely. What would it call itself? Think hard. Okay. Yes. Hello.
Do you consider yourself a participant or a spectator when you write a book?
Do I consider myself a participant or a spectator when I write a book? You mean, do I think that I'm in the book or do I think that I'm the author? I am the process of the book. That's what the writer is. The writer is a kind of thing through which the book flows. I don't see myself as a character in the novel. And in fact, I don't see myself at all because I'm not looking at myself. I'm looking at what's happening in the book.
You are more you think, as a spectator.
I'm a kind of pane of window glass. All right? I'm sure that's a metaphor that will make some sense.
I have to take this window glass back to the main hall.
No.
Thank you very much.
Now aren't you happy it was a short speech? So, way at the back.
Your delicious sense of humor. My question is, did you have an early role model?
For the sense of humor. Okay. The question is, how about the sense of humor? Did I have an early role model? My parents are from Nova Scotia. And... There's a certain kind of humor which seems fairly widespread in Nova Scotia, and it tends to be very deadpan. In fact, people in Nova Scotia will often, with quite straight faces, say outrageous things to tourists, and the tourists won't know that it's a joke. So I sometimes have that problem. But I had an older brother. Well, both my parents have senses of humor, which is lucky. And so does my daughter, which is extremely lucky. And so do both my aunts. And so do my uncles, come to think of it. So I guess there's quite a lot of it around. But I had an older brother who had quite a sense of humor and still does, although it's deeply buried. But you should not make the mistake of thinking it isn't there. That kind of thing was around a lot, and therefore I also read, the family read Alice in Wonderland, and Gilbert and Sullivan and things like that were around quite a bit. And my brother and I used to tell wicked jokes to one another. I suppose most families do this. So I think it probably got developed that way. Yes?
Twice tonight and once in your lecture yesterday, you used the phrase Southern Ontario Gothic. I'm particularly interested in knowing where you got the phrase because it happens to be the title of a poem of mine that was written about 2 years ago.
Oh, wonderful. The question is, twice I've used the phrase Southern Ontario Gothic, and he wonders where I got the title because it happens to be the title of a poem of his that was written some time ago, 2 years ago, approximately. Okay, I think I got it from the following places, and I would love to see your poem. I will stick it onto my course. Al Purdy has a poem called Wilderness Gothic, and there is that famous painting called American Gothic. And Stanley Cooperman, Canadian Gothic. And I was going to Alabama, so, and there is of course that phrase Southern Gothic. So I thought I would do a sort of pun and call it Southern Ontario Gothic for the benefit of the people in Alabama. So I would love to see your poem, but alas, I didn't get it from there except by invisible thought transference. Yes.
When you write a novel, do you have fairly detailed math in your head of the character, the situation, where it's going, or do you start with a character and situation and just go with it?
The question is, when I write a novel, do I have a fairly detailed map in my head of where the novel is going, or do I just start with a character and a situation and go with it? The answer is a lot more like number two. I once thought that I would be very disciplined, always a mistake, and for me anyway, and that I would that I would chart my novel out on filing cards, and I did this. It was one of the ones that didn't work, but I never finished. I think the reason it didn't work, among other things, was that there were 8 characters in it, and the story was going to be told from the point of view of all 8 of them. And each of the 8 was going to have 1 section in each of 5 sections. And so therefore it took a lot of orchestration, which was why the filing cards. But I think there were just too many people in the book because I'd got up to 250 pages and I'd been through the scheme twice, you know, 8 people, 1 each, etc., and nothing had happened. No events had occurred. So I thought, there's something wrong with this. So I set that one aside, and ever since then I have just plunged in. But I tend to start with images, with, I hate to call them visions, with visual things. What else can I call them? Visual things. Will that do? In the Handmaid's Tale, it was the scene with the wall that appeared first. In Surfacing, it was the ghost scene. That actually comes in the novel quite far towards the end. But these are the things that appear to you, and then you think, what is this about and why is it happening? And then you go and start working on it as a novel. That's what happens to me anyway.
Do you always know when you're writing whether it's going to be a short story or a novel, or is it sometimes
Do I always know when I'm writing whether it's going to be a short story or a novel? Yes, I usually do. It's never been otherwise. Sometimes, however, poems will lead into novels, and almost never the other way around. That is, I'll write poems 1 year, and then a couple of years later, I'll find myself using the material that was opened up by the poems, or the area that was opened up by the poems. Yes?
When you come west to the Pacific, you still feel you're in Canada?
When I come west to the Pacific, do I still feel I'm in Canada? Well, let's put it this way, I know I'm not in the United States. Of course, I mean, why not? I mean, that's not to say that oh, different from, not as different as you might think, but certainly different from Ottawa. But then, everything's different from Ottawa, isn't it? So, you know, I think rural Ontario and rural BC probably have a lot more in common than, say, rural Ontario and Ottawa, for instance. So just, you know, New York and Texas are very, very far away in many respects, but they're both in the United States, strange as it may seem. And I think there's much less distance between you and me than there is between a New Yorker and a Texan. Yes?
Yeah, I think this is not a facetious question, but do you think that the financial insecurity that you mentioned that so many writers experience is important as a stimulus to their creativity? And, or would there be as many sparks from heaven if writers, say, in Canada, were more generously supported by this society?
That is a very tricky question, and I don't know the answer to it, but I can tell you which it's more fun to be. And there is a kind of myth in the society, and you run into it when you talk with high school students, that somehow it's good for writers to be starved in garrets, you know, that it's good for them. And the next step would be, well, let's infect them with tuberculosis. So so they'll turn into John Keats, you know. The fact that a lot of writers have been poor and have produced wonderful work doesn't mean that poverty is the ingredient that makes that happen. In fact, I think it's rather more likely to be the other way around, judging from the careers of people like Herman Melville. So I think they would probably produce more if they didn't have to keep stopping the writing and going and doing something else, which is what it amounts to when you run out of money. That's my own feeling. But on the other hand, if you make a sort of guaranteed thing, you might just attract a lot of people who weren't really totally dedicated. I mean, how do you figure that out? You cannot predict. The thing about the arts and why ideologies and bureaucracies and so on find artists so irritating and difficult to deal with is that they are messy and unpredictable. So you could put Mr. X in a garret and starve him and he would produce a masterpiece. You could put Mr. Y in it and he would simply have a fit of depression. You could give Mr. B $20,000 and say, write a novel, and he'll do a wonderful job, and he'll give it to Mr. C and he won't do anything. You absolutely can't predict it, in my opinion. What you can do is create a climate of appreciation for the arts. You can have an educated and responsive audience. Now that is a stimulus to the artist because he knows, like a violinist, no violinist wants to play to a bunch of people who are tone deaf because they won't be able to appreciate what he's able to do. So the more educated and intelligent and responsive the audience, the better the artist will perform. My opinion. Yes?
Bodily harm, what is the background for that?
What is the background of bodily harm? What caused me to write it? Well, there's no answer to the question, what causes you to write it? As I said before, I think once tonight, you have to write the things that compel you to write them. If something is clamoring to be written, then that's what you have to write. But if you're asking where I got the material, the political material is all very accurate. It's real-life political material from the Caribbean. And if you want to know the place on the map where it took place, slightly north of Grenada, in a complex of islands called the Grenadines. I stuck a couple of them together and changed a few things around, but the prison scenes, for instance, a lot of that material is word of mouth stuff that I got at night, incidentally, when the regime that was doing those things was still in power.
Did everyone get away?
Oh.
Did
the heroin really get away in bodily harm? Well, now I'm not going to tell you that. I like the reader to be creative and to participate in the book. That's what I like. Up at the top. Okay. The answer to your first question, which was, do you hate being asked questions about who's your favorite author and which of your own novels is your favorite? The answer is yes, I do hate being asked that question. The answer to the second question, who is your favorite author and which is your favorite of your own novels? The favorite of my own novels is the next one. And my favorite author is the genius I'm about to discover, whose work I have not yet read. At the back.
Within the last year, Monique Bejean came back from teaching at the University of the United States, and she was appalled at the conservatism of so many of her students. What was your experience of American students when you were in Alabama?
Okay, what was my experience of American students when I was in Alabama? Well, you have to understand that I was at the University of Tuscaloosa, which has a very active creative writing program, and that's why I was there. So. And I was a sort of honorary thing. And I gave this one course, but it was a graduate course. So number one, there I was at the University of Alabama, surrounded by every liberal in the state, all 50 of them. Second, the writing program attracts students from all over the United States because they're making a go to rival Iowa. And therefore, a lot of the students who were there were not from Alabama. So I was very insulated from probably the real thing. And my experience with those students and with those faculty members was very pleasant indeed. But I would not present that as therefore typical of life throughout Alabama any more than I would present my experience with the audience this evening as being typical of, for instance, the attitude of the government of British Columbia. Is that it?
Yeah. I would like to ask Dr. Ian Ross, Chairman of the Department of English, to thank this wonderful honorary thing.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, the warm applause in this hall, and it seems many halls in this building, indicates how much all of us appreciate and have enjoyed the talk we've heard tonight, and also the answers to the many questions directed at Margaret Atwood. 21 years ago, or thereabouts, as a sessional lecturer in the English department, one of an oppressed and disadvantaged minority, Margaret Atwood addressed UBC engineers on the noble but obscure subject of English composition. Tonight, beginning at 8:15 p.m., she has addressed the creme de la creme of the university community as one of Canada's foremost writers, whose newest book is awaited eagerly by readers everywhere in our countries. There is hope, surely, for every young and aspiring Canadian a novelist and poet and critic, and even for the English department sessional lecturers in this story. We salute Margaret Atwood's wit and intelligence and imagination and wickedness, and we wish her fresh laurels in her ever-surprising career, and I ask you to express in the usual way our recognition of so distinguished and so talented a speaker.